This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena, the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Let's talk about social historical change today, Sharat, or rather change in general. Recent news of certain famous deaths signal just how much is changing, how we're at the cusp of certain things passing and certain other things emerging.
So you talked about the passing of certain individuals. I mean, we had the death of John Berger, the author of
Ways of Seeing.
Ways of Seeing. Yep. And then because we just had the death of Zygmunt Bauman, a Polish social theorist, also very important. And he died in his 90s, like John mm-hmm. Berger. And very recently, again, the death of a journalist, a member of my tribe, Claire Hollingworth, mm-hmm. who at the age of 105, she broke the story of the Nazi invasion of Poland. She actually saw the tanks massing on the Polish border, or across the Polish border, as it were. So, you know, and I always, every time somebody dies who's lived a long life, I think, how did they experience change? We know the 20th century, we went from horse-drawn carriages and gas flames that lit up streets to, you know, nanotechnology and bots that can actually, you know, swim in your bloodstream and repair organs in your body. It's extraordinary telescoping of, you know, in terms of technology that, you know. So I think the 21st century is just extraordinary. And for somebody to live through that,
yeah,
even more extraordinary.
The key thing about the three figures you mentioned is that they were in many ways informed by the Second World War. Berger and Bauman in particular, that was when the major contributions were set. And I wonder all the time, in fact, today, if we have really overcome that legacy, if we really understood that turning point, you know, because in many ways, if you look at where the major conflict areas are, if you look at the fault lines between the major powers today, they seem very, very reminiscent of conflicts that were supposedly resolved 60, 70 years ago.
So one of the things that I picked up in reading about Zygmunt Bauman's death was how his identity as a Jew shaped his experience as a young man. So he was bullied and, you know, he was shamed for being who he was from his community. And it developed in him not just a lifelong concern about the marginalized and dispossessed, and especially in the period of rapid and intense globalization, but also on the question of identity. So you had that. He, you know, later in his life, if it was discovered that he was a member of a core, you know, belonging to the Communist Party. He was a member of the Communist Party in Poland. And there you see these other tensions that develop, right, between the kind of internationalist outlook of the communist movement that he joined and the more parochial, or to use a less negative word, nationalistic, mode. And so mm-hmm. the nationalists say, well, the communists came in and helped massacre, you know, nationalist Poles who resisted, you know, communism. So those things haven't gone away. In fact, we see ourselves constantly swinging from one end to another. I mean, it's almost like, and this I think is one model of change, it's actually not a line going towards the future, but really a pendulum swing. And yeah, you have, you know, and so the increased parochialism, today we see the nationalism, the patriot, you know, the policies dress up in patriotic garb that is now kind of shaping the world in significant ways.
It was not long ago, too, that we can recall the euphoria around progress, especially with declarations regarding the end of history, for example, where the Soviet bloc collapsed. And at that point, people really thought that was a triumphant turning point.
This is Francis Fukuyama, the idea that the liberal democratic model was going to be the dominant model for the world.
Yep, the dominant paradigm that we have to work around, you know. And I recall, at least as a young political scientist in training, that was my undergrad years, that this was largely the taken for granted assumption that there's only one kind of business you can do, and that because all talks of international solidarity against the oppressor and the you know, communism as an alternative can no longer hold, we can really only think in one way. So while that's out of the picture, right, we still nonetheless have the same questions. For example, expansions of empire with China and its so-called expansion into the South and the ongoing battle over who controls the Middle East. The conflicts have intensified technologically in terms of the kind of warfare being used. The scale of destruction has gotten far worse. That's the curiosity I bring when I look at these things. What's changed and what hasn't? And how do we think through those things?
You know, we began by talking about those individuals and the experience, right? So experience at an individual level. Needless to say, social scientists and, you know, perhaps philosophers and such are trying to look at the broader canvas, look at patterns, to draw some conclusions about the nature of change. But, you know, very recently we spoke to Shahrudin Ma'arouf, you know, the author of a book on ideas of development in Malay society. And when we talked about it, and I asked him, you know, what reproduces the kind of dominant structures in Malay society, I mean, his question to me was, why do we think change is natural? Mm-hmm. When in fact, for him, the status quo and stasis is actually what is in some ways to be expected. We shouldn't be expecting change. We should be expecting no change.
Yeah.
And that when change happens, it's actually quite extraordinary. Mm-hmm. If I, you know, I don't mean to misquote him here, but I think that's
exactly what he said. Yeah.
And so, you know, again, we are caught up in our individual experience. Even the last 20 years in Malaysia, we had have extraordinary sea change in terms of politics. And at one point, everybody thought, well, this was the inevitable march towards a very different kind of political system. And of course, now looking back over, 10 years or so, that optimism has been dampened. And maybe, you know, this is the problem of being an individual. You kind of want it to happen in your lifetime. And perhaps you're much more of a cog in the wheel rather than, or as, you know, Antonio Gramsci, the Italian communist and social theorist, suggested, we're all more likely to be manure for the revolution than be at the revolution.
Probably. Yeah, we're part of the world spirit, right? History unfolding. And this is just one moment in a broader continuum. But I do think, though, despite all that we changing, certain core attitudes remain. There's a certain affinity to a kind of tribal outlook. And this mimics in a lot of ways, rhetorically or emotionally, filial affinities. The idea that as social beings, we gravitate towards familiar structures where there is authority. There's somebody to be followed, and there are rules that we must follow, and that we must be disciplined in order for these rules to be followed so that we can expect a certain shape to society and so on and so forth. This translates to racial conflicts, national identities, these expectations of very fixed and concrete ways of being, which I see as still compelling, despite however technological and progressive human society appears to be. So in that sense, we still, despite all that's changed over the hundreds of years, remain tied to those things. Now, I get it that familiar structures change, right? That the nuclear family is a recent construction. Marriage continues to be recoded through the ages to respond to changing social dynamics. But it's the idea that we must somehow be absorbed or belong to a bigger social unit, and that the social unit can be somehow be understood or defined along biological, physiological bloodlines, right, still remains compelling, you know, and we haven't seen an alternative to that.
Well, you know, you think that, say, the communist movement, for instance, or, you know, countries that adopt the communism as an ideology would get beyond the bloodline issue. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've just completed this fascinating book called The Rise and Fall of the House of Bo by John Garneau. And it's the story of this Red Princeling, as they call them, you know, son of a revolutionary leader in China, who himself became a major figure in China until in 2012, when he and his wife were charged with murder and
this
corruption.
This is the famous mayor, right?
That's right, Bo Zilai.
Yeah.
And Bo Zilai, so the story of it, it's because you go back in time and the kinds of things, and the very tiny books, a very slim volume, you know, Fuad, but so much of the story turns on generational conflict, loyalties. In fact, there used to be a saying in China, this is a Maoist slogan, that that a Red Sea was better than a Black A. Mm-hmm. And this was an attempt to give... And so, you know, the system at that point was not meritocratic. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. if you were a son of a cadre or daughter of the cadre, a communist cadre, you could get into a university against with lower grades than somebody who was from a tainted bourgeois family mm-hmm. or for whatever reason had unrevolutionary credentials. Mm-hmm. You know, but just think the Maoists would think that yeah. way, that they believe in this kind of bloodline issue that, you know, somehow even contributions to the revolution were somehow carried in your genes, or maybe not genes, but carried in your family loyalties.
Mm-hmm. If you remember the introduction to Imagine Communities, Benedict Anderson talked about what spurred him to write on nationalism, especially at that time. And he said it was the compelling whole of nationalistic ideals. And one of the examples he gave was the battle... war between China and Vietnam, right? How is it that two countries built on revolutions that inspired revolutionaries from all across the world to emulate and model their success can somehow end up battling one another? So he thought, okay, at this point, and he's an avowed committed leftist, right, throughout his life. He said, well, I have to look at this. And that's what eventually drew him to explore the linguistic valences of nationalism and so forth. But we keep coming to that. The idea of an abstract humanity where we all have inherent dignity and stuff like that works, or rather it has certain legal practicalities. But whether or not we really believe in it in our everyday life, in our everyday sort of interaction, is a separate question. I would say it seems that we don't quite buy into that, and that we are somehow more at home among the familiar and among those whose behavior and ways of life we can more or less expect to be the same. All right, let's take a break. I'm sure there's a lot more we can explore for the second part of the show, but you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside Shark Curtain this week on Night School, where we discuss change on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside Shark Curtain, and this week we're talking about social historical change. What remains the same despite all the progress and advances we can claim? Or what, in fact, you know, on the contrary, has really departed us. It's not an easy thing to tell, given how complicated human society is and the limited views we have of it.
You know, when I think of Claire Hollingworth, and I think, wow, to live to 105, and if your brain still function and you're in reasonable health and not in pain or anything like that, what an extraordinary privilege it is to live a long time, because you get to witness mm-hmm. this bumbling creature called humanity, you know, the human being, kind of fashion the world, you know, in their own image. And I think, but all of us, most of us don't have a kind of dispassionate view of things, mm-hmm. Especially with regard to where humanity is going. I think partly because we're so invested in it. I mean, we feel the pain when we make mistakes. We feel the pain when you see the brutalities. And today, the brutalities are there every day, you know, available to us almost instantaneously, mm-hmm. right? So I was watching something on television about this Yazidi Kurd psychiatrist who's, you know, who's German in terms of nationality, helping women, vulnerable women who have been, you know, violated by IS soldiers. I mean, the stories they tell for just, you know, it made me choke in anger. And you think, there is no hope for humanity. I mean, this is just proof of the barbarism that is so close beneath the surface, you know, the violation of Yazidi girls at the age of 8, you know, mm-hmm. By hundreds, literally, soldiers. And so you think, oh, you know, there's no progress. And it's very easy to get depressed and pessimistic about humanity. So I sometimes... kind of search for somebody who's got a dispassionate view. I want to be able mm-hmm. to take myself out of the moment and view, you know, what's happening with less emotion, so I could see something good, perhaps. Or
yeah, I'm inclined to think that there's something exciting about being young in the aftermath of the Second World War, because you gotta remember that it was evidence that fascism had been defeated.
But the privations were intense. I mean, even...
No, definitely.
Among those who won, right?
No, definitely. But that's why the optimism is all the more cherished, because it was something yearned for upon this rubble of destruction, that there is something after the rubble, which we can't quite see now. The rubble has been piling more and more. But what we are constantly facing are just reasons to be upset.
Was that an allusion to Walter Benjamin's kind of like...
Angel of History?
Angel of History, the rubble of...
The Angel of History pointing forward but always looking back, right? We must also note that there is something about our evolutionary impulses that seeks threats so that we can be better prepared to face them. So
we mean like our reptilian nature.
Part of the reptilian brain that we have orients us to be extra careful. And this even translates to how we react to the things we see on our newsfeed when we scroll our Facebook, even in the private confines of our bedroom, right? Even though we're in that context, doesn't remove us from certain evolutionary impulses we have. So, and Facebook likes to cater to that, right? Because once it traces the algorithms of our preferred styles of browsing the web, it will keep feeding us with the kind of stuff that we want. So I think that's a way of contextualizing the dread that we feel when we look at current events, right? And of course, newspapers will try to, in a certain way, respond to that register. But going back to your point of pessimism too, I wonder if that pessimism and dread comes from an overestimation of what we can do, right? I
mean, as human beings, or even as an individual, right?
Because we can't change the world. We just have the, 80, if we're lucky, 80 odd years of our life here, and the set of choices that are given within that time frame. And if we can do our best within that time frame, then I think that's the most we can hope for. And I think that should be enough. It does get overwhelming to see how little we are in the grand scheme of the cosmos.
It's very liberating to feel your insignificance, I think. I think that's a good thing. And over the years, and we've done almost 3 years of Night School now, we have covered the issue of change. I remember an episode where we did with Sean Matthews from Nottingham University. We talked about this framing of change in terms of the dominant, the residual, and the emergent. Mm-hmm. You know, the dominant being the present and what the structures we have, the residual, what is left over from a previous time, and then what is emergent is the new on the horizon. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very productive way of making sense or giving order to the kinds of things we see happening before us. The other thing, of course, is just to, it's something that I am now constantly tweeting about, and it's a term I keep using in relation to Malaysian politics, is the logic of majoritarian politics. Mm-hmm. There is a logic that's both cultural and social in the kind of majoritarian politics that we practice, right? And so, and we see that unfolding, and somehow, without getting into this thing that this is inevitable or anything, but you can see that when you have a particular discourse and it shapes the way people think, that structuring of thought has a logic to it. It can unfold. It can develop the next stage and the next step. Mm-hmm. What is the next step? If you believe this, then what is the next step? And if you get to that step, what is the stage further? And in a way that can be quite detrimental. So we don't see. So we might see political expediency or machinations and stuff like that operating. But there's sometimes a deeper logic. So I think in Malaysia, the majoritarian logic really, in some ways, is driving the politics of the day beyond mm-hmm. the immediate current configurations of politicians and political figures.
I agree, yeah. Lately, too, if you look at certain broad electoral patterns, you can trace the tensions around these changes that we talk about, around these massive, overwhelming social structural changes in the urban-rural divide, right? For a while, we thought that urbanization was inevitable and that sort of the rural electorate is something that will just follow with the times, right? If things go a certain liberal democratic capitalist way, then we can look forward to greater urbanization and a certain type of cosmopolitan politics. But recently, there is a pushback, rather, against that trend, right? And this is seen in, for example, the victory of Trump, right? Even though it's not really rural-urban, but nowadays commentators are increasingly using that paradigm to explain what are the infrastructural and consequently attitude gaps between the two electorates. And of course, Thailand and Malaysia as well, right? That modernization has created polarizations that are only going to be increasingly hardened, you know, rather than to melt away into the air all that is solid, right?
There you are, you know, alluding to Marx.
Yeah, so
or Marshall Berman.
Oh, is it Marshall? All right.
Marshall Berman
quotes Marx. Marx, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it's one thing to look at change in terms of these broad trends, but the tensions underneath that trend, the tensions that we live every day socially, is where these things are played out, right? And I'm not sure if elections necessarily settle the score, right? And they clearly don't, because after the elections, what we see nowadays is that those results are always contested, right? Whether it's Egypt, whether it's Ukraine, people find it very skeptical. And I wonder if it has a lot to do with that majoritarian sentiment, right? That even though you're not a majority, you feel the entitlement of one, you know?
I think one of the things that, I mean, because you brought up Marshall Berman's book, I think the question of methodology is quite fascinating. One of the things they say about Zygmunt Bauman is that he introduced into American and Anglo-American social sciences, you know, a more philosophical framing of issues. And, you know, in that, I think sometimes when you come from outside a discipline, you can ask fresh questions. Mm-hmm. But one of the things you see typically in social sciences, and you know, is you see people try to build systems. They're trying to see how something works, right? Mm-hmm. So they have everything kind of working together. The other, you know, and it's kind of synchronic, right? It's kind of laid out, as it were, as a system. The other thing that people often do is a model of change is like to see something internally shifting, and you know, we have the kind of dialectical mm-hmm. method. There's another thing, and I think Marshall Berman exemplifies this, is this very painstaking, detailed, and attentive, close reading of social phenomena, something that you see mm-hmm. in the world around you. And the book, All That Solid Melts Into Air, is actually a series of essays, mm-hmm. each of the one advancing the idea of the experience of modernity, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, I don't know if it's in the preface or he says in the end, he says, well, this book actually need not end. I mean, he could just keep adding mm-hmm. yet more readings of specific issues, right? Whether it's a novel or it's the building of, you know, it's urban design, you know? Mm-hmm. All these things, all these instances help you understand. So I think maybe one of the things to do with Malaysia, if we were going to talk about social change or lack of change mm-hmm. in Malaysia, is to do a series of close readings mm-hmm. of different things that might kind of add up to something without necessarily purporting to be a kind of totalizing mm-hmm. view of the Malaysian system.
But I wonder if we can't help but to always come back to that total view, because it's so tempting as a way to organize the complexity of our society. That's where these categories help pacify certain anxieties we have about the differences we live among, right? So not only are we racially/ethnically different, there's also the linguistic components that come into that. Religious differences somehow are woven into that as well. And that in the end, we always fall back to this big picture. You're Chinese, I'm Malay, Indians are there than lain-lain, even farther away. And this is sort of how Malaysia will be. I mean, this is how everybody thinks, right? Because we need that big picture to fit all these different schemes and different changes into a coherent narrative, right? Which somehow we keep coming back to despite all the euphoria after 2008, you know? In 2013, where people literally stopped at the highways to march to Kelana Jaya Stadium. I really sensed something was in the air that night. But, you know, here we are 3 years later and it's business as usual.
Yeah, so this is it, right? So when people were marching and people were euphoric, was it that they were partisan and they were loyalists of the particular parties that won? Or were they really caught up in something larger or different, which had to do with this feeling that change was necessary for the country. And you hear this in what kind of commentaries that are made constantly about the Malaysian economy, that was moribund. And people will say, we support the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement precisely because it would be a game changer. And you know, in today's business parlance, you know, and they like to use the word a disruptor. So disruptive technologies, disruptive business, businesses, is all the rage.
Yeah.
It's like you can't find more kind of ardent, cheerleaders for change and revolution, as it were, than in the capitalist class.
Marx called that ages ago, yeah.
And so, you know, but what is it, what do social scientists do with, or even philosophers do with the question of disruptive technologies and disruptive business practices? You know, that I think, that's a word that really kind of is like calling out for some sort of interrogation.
Oh, definitely, especially the way it's used, right? Like you say, the way that people deploy that word, you know, they're so cavalier about it. You know, when in actuality, you have people losing their jobs, taxi drivers protesting, you know, it really disrupts lives and families and social organizations.
Yeah, yeah. So the disruptive is a positive expression, right? So technocrats, entrepreneurs, we hear it all the time. On BFM, we talk about it. It's good because the idea is they always have become moribund. Their stakeholders have perhaps squeezed, the public good from the setup and are now controlling and monopolizing things.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what a disruptor does, it is even though it causes displacement, but it might be a displacement of something bad, crony capitalists, for instance. These are, possibilities. So it's not that I kind of think the word disruptor is hollow. Mm-hmm. I just think it requires a kind of interrogation because what they are celebrating there is the idea that you need a structure that forces everybody to re-look what they're doing and how they're doing it and play the game differently, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, it was said, I think before the invasion of Iraq, I think the neocons of America, the neoconservatives, as they call it, neocons, the idea of creative destruction, of course, the appalling loss of life, the collateral damage, everything, right, aside, there was this celebration of the possibility of reconfiguring the Middle East through these awful wars. Mm-hmm. And, one part of my head is saying, no, it's never justified. One part of my thing is saying, well, okay, I can see what they're trying to do in thinking this through, even if I don't agree with their methods and the conclusions they come to.
The way I pitch that to my students is encapsulated in the saying that things have to get worse before they get better, right? There is this...
Oh, it's darkest before dawn.
Yeah, but I think there's no doubt about the price that we have to pay if we really want change. Something radically transformative has to happen, and it's going to hurt a lot of people's feelings because we're so stuck to these cycles of living a certain way, thinking a certain way, that if we're really serious about change, then we really have to, quote-unquote, revolutionize our way of thinking, right? And that's... the left is as equally culpable for this attitude, right? Because that's what revolution was about. You got to break an egg to make an omelette, right?
Yeah,
Did Lenin say that, by the way?
Yeah, I was thinking the same quote. I was trying to remember who to attribute it to. But the idea, again, the left and the right in the 20th century were actually on the same page when it comes to questions of modernization.
Correct.
They had the same attitude towards the factory.
Yeah,
Very triumphant. They both wanted us to become factory workers. But the idea was it was an elevated position. This was
the pinnacle of
humanity. We would be good workers. We would be happy workers. We would be workers with that had our welfare taken care of. I mean, we take the kind of leftist view of things, right? And so, is that what we are meant to be? Or is there some other paradigm? And I think this question emerges now at the end of the 20th century precisely because the age of the Anthropocene, the idea that we are damaging the planet, mm-hmm. we're changing the planet so significantly that we really need to rethink what progress means. You know, maybe low growth is actually what we want.
Yeah.
We want
I don't think it's maybe at this point.
At this point, it's been a story of low growth. But you know, and celebrating it rather than think, oh, this is a problem that needs to be solved.
Because the GDP model assumes that your so-called well-being is to be measured by productivity and consumption, which requires more plastic in the world, basically. And we just have no more space for that. You know, sometimes when I'm stuck in a traffic jam on LDP on some Wednesday afternoon or something, I really have asked for an asteroid just to hit us all right there and then.
I hope nobody's listening to you because, Fuad, I have so much to live for. I have at least 30 more years on planet Earth and I intend to, you know, experience a little more before I go. So no to your asteroid. I don't know who you're talking to. Tell me.
I was being flippant, really. Half flippant, rather. In any case, we have to stop our discussion here. Four recommendations. What do you have in mind, Sharad?
I think that, you know, there's something I've always recommended. This is a kind of novel, really, you know, by E.L. Doctorow called Welcome to Hard Times, which has, if you kind of read it in a particular way, has a notion of how humanity comes together, you know, and builds things and then it all kind of disappears. The ephemeral nature, when you have the long view, the ephemeral nature of humanity and the things we build. But of course, there was that book, and I don't know if I've recommended this, Peter Frankopan's The Silk Roads. So looking at human history again, the broad sweep of, you know, of 1,000 years, but centered on the dynamics coming from Central Asia, lots of Persian sources. And, you know, it told this wonderful story. And I actually tweeted out to Peter Frankopan because he's on Twitter. And I said, I love the story you tell, but tell me, where is the individual in this story? Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. you know, and he didn't tweet me back.
Maybe it's this bourgeois impulse or something, but we all have that Napoleonic side of us to be this protagonist in some sweeping drama of history or something like that, you know, or we're witnessing the cusp of something new. And I think that's where I think Hegel comes in quite fittingly for us, in the sense that we are all, it's not just to say that we're all insignificant, but that history is like this total shift of the geist that plays out, you know. And that's why history is fascinating too, because we see epics, characters told in the form of wars, in the form of countries, you know, in the form of machineries and so forth. I have two suggestions, perhaps they're more theoretically oriented, but the first is this book by Andrew Levine, a political scientist in Wisconsin. It's called A Future for Marxism? It's a theoretical book, but half of it details the decline of the left. How is it that this utopian project, which was once so global in its in the solidarity it compelled, has basically lost and faded into insignificance? And he's going to chart out also theoretical alternatives, certain readings of Marxism to respond to the loss and a hopefully potential revival. The second book is Civilization and Its Discontents by Freud, which is so relevant. And it basically checks the so-called pursuit of happiness that accompanies growth, that accompanies the sophistication of human societies and human technology. And the bottom line is, he says, all that we can hope for is the end of neurotic suffering for a common unhappiness. So not all unhappiness is suffering. Sometimes we forget that, right? So the world overwhelms us. We get a bit unhappy. And I think it's smart to do that. It's a way of you telling yourself that things have to be fixed. But that doesn't have to entail suffering. So that's what I tell myself, at least, in those moments when I do ask for an asteroid to hit us. In any case, Sharad, you're on Twitter.
At Sharad Kutin.
You can email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook. BFM Night School, just type that on the search space. Be sure to like it if you haven't yet. Thank you for listening. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahman alongside Sharad Kutin as usual. And this is BFM Night School. Download the BFM app for convenience. You can find that on the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store. And be sure to follow the show that way. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.